We got some Paul, we got a little Mark, and some Mick, Ryan Zuckerberg, Mulvaney, and more. Coming up today from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, April the 11th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today deep in the details of the American economy as presented to us by this morning's release of the minutes from the Federal Reserve's most recent meeting 3 weeks ago. We don't usually spend a whole lot of time on Fed minutes because Fed minutes, am I right? But we figured brand new Chairman Jay Powell's first meeting, which this one was a good one to look at real quick. First of all, the economy is fine. In fact, the Fed thinks the Trump tax cuts and the big boost in federal spending will give the economy, quote, a significant boost in the short term. Economists, however, and as we say from time to time, love to look long term. So members of the Fed Board of Governors also said these two things, that there are, first of all, quote, downside risks to the economic outlook from all the deficit spending. And number two, a strong majority of participants, these were all quotes, viewed the prospect of retaliatory trade actions by other countries and other issues and uncertainties associated with trade policies as downside risks. So, good and bad and more to come on economic news as there always is. Very soon, Paul Ryan is not going to have to worry about deficits or trade policy or pretty much anything in that economic policy world he has spent so very much of his time doing the past 20 years in Congress. Ryan announced today he is going to leave Congress next January, which is going to have a whole bunch of ripple effects. We got Marketplace's Kimberly Adams live on the phone from Washington to talk that over. Hey, Kimberly.
Hi, Kai.
So first of all, let's do the political story, I guess. He has been wrangling a troubled GOP caucus, let us say, but also raising a boatload of money for the party, right?
Yeah, just in the first quarter of 2018, he raised $11 million. So that means for just this election cycle, he's raised more than $54 million. Now, even before announcing he wasn't going to run again, his campaign transferred $40 million of that money to the National Republican Campaign Committee, which helps other GOP House races. And honestly, with so many Republicans trying to keep their distance from President Trump, Ryan's fundraising power has become particularly important.
Ryan has, as we know, been the economic policy guy in the GOP. I mean, he has been chair of the Budget Committee. He's been doing this for a very long time. First of all, tell us a little bit about that and how he got there. But also, where does the party go from here on economic policy without Ryan?
So, right, he had a degree in economics and used that in his long time in the House. He was chair of the House Budget Committee from 2011 to 2015. He had a very brief stint as chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, which is the main tax writing group in the House. And then later on that year in 2015, reluctantly took on the speakership after John Boehner retired. So where do we go now? The party is having a really difficult time kind of landing on a central economic policy. It used to be the party of fiscal conservatism. But obviously, as we saw with this tax plan and the recent spending bill, that's kind of been blown out of the water. So you have one section of the GOP that says, hey, we need a balanced budget amendment. And the other party that's like, eh, we need to get more money for the military, regardless of what it costs.
All right. So wait. So let's get to that for a minute, because we have talked the past couple of days on this program about the CBO budget projection that came out the other day. $1 trillion annual deficit starting in 2020 through 2028. That is also very much part of his legacy.
Right. But he has also had another chunk of focus during his time in Congress, which is entitlement reform. Yeah. And Ryan has said from jump that, look, these tax cuts are great. They're important for the economy, but it's not going to give us the boost we need unless there's reforms to Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. And from his point of view, he did all he could on that. That's something he referenced this morning when reporters asked him about it.
But I feel from all the budgets that I've passed, normalizing entitlement reform, pushing the cause of entitlement reform and the House passing entitlement reform. I'm very proud of that fact. But yeah, of course, more work needs to be done.
So he was able to get it through the House, but those efforts never made it through the Senate.
So where is entitlement reform right now anyway?
Congress does not really seem to have much of an appetite for this ahead of the midterms, but the Trump administration has been working on this. Back in January, they gave states the okay to impose work requirements for Medicaid. And then just yesterday, Trump signed an executive order to do the same for other kinds of federal assistance like food or housing aid. The thing is, a lot of states already have pretty strict requirements on this. My colleague Chrissy Clark has done a ton of reporting on this on the Marketplace podcast, The Uncertain. certain hour. And one of the things she found in her reporting was that especially when it comes to cash welfare assistance, mm-hmm. there are just far, far, far fewer families getting that money than, say, 20 years ago.
Kimberly Adams on the line from Washington talking about Paul Ryan's departure and where things might go from here economically for the GOP. Kimberly, thanks a lot.
No problem.
Let me just say, by the way, Kimberly mentioned the uncertain hour and Chrissy Clark and all of that. It was some extraordinary reporting. You can get the whole podcast at marketplace.org, The Uncertain Hour. First season was entitlement reform. Second season was regulations, actually, which I knew. I just forgot. All right. Anyway, aside from the soon-to-be former speaker, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg got most of the attention on Capitol Hill today. But there was another hearing going on, as happens in Congress, more sparsely attended, to be sure. Mick Mulvaney was the featured attraction in his capacity as acting director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Of particular interest today was payday lending, as Marketplace's Ryan Kailath explains.
First, a quick refresh on how these loan companies operate. From Ed Mirzwinski of the U.S. Public Interest Research Group.
You need money by payday, so you write them a check for $120.
That's the collateral.
And they give you $100.
The loan.
So it costs you $20 to borrow $100 for a week or two.
If that sounds exorbitant, Mirzwinski says, you just haven't been desperate enough. Keep rolling that loan over every week for a year, and you're paying over 1,000% interest.
The average payday loan interest rate is 390-something percent. But interestingly, 15 states and the District of Columbia ban it.
Calling it predatory lending. This is where the CFPB comes in. The agency had spent 4 years drafting a payday lending rule. It required lenders to check a borrower's ability to repay before making the loan. That rule was finalized in October. Several weeks later, Mick Mulvaney took over.
And he halted that implementation. He's taken the cop off the beat.
Democrat Carolyn Maloney is a U.S. representative who questioned Mulvaney in today's hearing. She says the bureau's also dropped lawsuits against payday lenders. And even though Mulvaney's not really pushing them anymore, the payday lending companies are now actually suing the CFPB over the rule, calling it draconian and saying it would, quote, virtually eliminate their industry. Mulvaney's back on the Hill tomorrow for more questioning. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Up the eastern seaboard in lower Manhattan, Wall Street today was a little bit bumpy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As I said, Mark Zuckerberg survived day two of his congressional testimony today. It was the House Commerce Committee. Questions were a tad more informed and pointed than the Senate provided yesterday. California Democrat Anna Eshoo represents Silicon Valley.
Are you willing to change your business model in the interest of protecting individual privacy?
Congresswoman, we have made and are continuing to make changes to reduce the amount of
data. No, are you willing to change your business model in the interest of protecting individual privacy?
Congresswoman, I'm not sure what that means.
Well, maybe we can help here. Facebook sells ads against what it knows its users to be interested in. One way, maybe the way, that they figure out what you're interested in is the like button, that little thumbs up that may well be the most powerful tool in social media. Every single time we click on it, we narrow ourselves down beautifully for advertisers and researchers and others. And the very nature of what that button stands for, the validation that a whole lot of people get from it, keeps us coming back for more. Marketplace's Rima Kreis explains that one.
Before you and I knew it as the like button, Facebook developers had another name for it, the awesome button.
It's one of those things that was lost in history.
Soleo Cuervo helped design the feature about a decade ago, also lost in history. He says before the blue thumbs up, they experimented with a star symbol, a plus sign. He says the feature kept failing so-called Zuck reviews.
We used to call it the curse of the awesome button because the project felt a little bit cursed. It just always seemed to get stuck in review.
Cuervo, who now owns a design and venture firm, says that's partly because developers were scared that the like or awesome button would make people lazy, that it would lead to less posting. They were dead wrong.
Rather than cannibalizing comments, it did the opposite. It created an environment in which people were more motivated to leave posts.
The like button officially left product purgatory in 2009. And since then, we've seen iterations of that little iconic symbol all over social media, including on this popular app owned by Facebook.
This is my Instagram. Oh, I got a like. Who is it? I don't know who this person is.
In Los Angeles, outside a mall with her friend, 23-year-old Gabby Weir scrolls through her Instagram. She shows me pictures of her mimosa-filled brunches at cliffsides in Italy, lots of selfies, and under each carefully worded caption, dozens of likes.
I think, like, my median like is, like, I don't know, 115.
Which is a lot.
And she says sometimes if a picture doesn't perform, she'll take it down. Still, Weir says how many likes she gets, not really important. Her friend standing next to her, Amber Tolliver, gives her the side eye.
And I really couldn't care less what people think of
me. Oh, yeah, right.
Yes, that's true. I don't care what people think of me in terms of,
so
like...
How would you know how many likes that you're getting? Like, why would you even think about it if it didn't matter to you? Like,
no, I'm not saying it doesn't matter.
So it does matter.
The thing is, it matters to a lot of people. The reason the like button has been so successful is because people, well, they like to be liked, says Adam Alter, a marketing professor at NYU.
The experience of getting a like is a lot like a drug taken by someone who's addicted to the drug. It's just a massive dose of reward. It's a huge boost to well-being.
Alter says the like button is what makes social media platforms so irresistible, sort of like a slot machine. You never know how well a post is going to do, so you keep going back.
That's how the attention economy works. It's critical that people keep devoting their attention to that particular platform. Otherwise, it loses its key source of revenue.
Money, he says, is not the currency here. Our personal data is. The more time we spend on the platform, the more data we're handing over to advertisers. And when we like things on Facebook, we're making their jobs easier. Say I like Lady Gaga on Facebook. I wouldn't really, but if I did, then I could expect to see ads maybe for her concert on my newsfeed. That's not an entirely new concept, says Sandra Matz, a professor of organizational behavior at Columbia University.
The new part is that we're now taking those interests and those behaviors and we're translating it into psychological profiles.
Matt says researchers have created models tying our likes to certain personality traits. For example, following Lady Gaga means I'm more likely to be an extrovert. And Matt says if you tally up all the likes someone makes on Facebook, personality predictions become that much more accurate. With just 10 likes, she says a computer model can predict your personality better than a colleague could. 150 likes, and it's better than a parent.
And around 250 to 300 likes to be better than someone's spouse even.
Matz's research shows that targeting ads to people based on their personality led to more clicks and buys. She says this idea of personalization
can have a very positive effect on people's lives if it's done right. And if it's done in a way that is more transparent to the user than what we currently have.
Because without transparency, she says that kind of targeting, it can exploit our weaknesses. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
We've been hearing stories this year from people whose lives in this economy were changed by the financial crisis, part of our coverage of the last 10 years in our collective economic experience called Divided Decade. Today, Sarah Catherine Walmsley, a professional matchmaker in Atlanta, Georgia.
Almost 20 years ago in 1998, right after I had graduated from college, I started a group dating concept called 8 at 8. We get four single men and four single women to go to dinner together at 8 o'clock. We are basically headhunters for love. 10 years ago, none of us were spending money on anything. Everyone froze. I froze, clients froze, and it was scary because you didn't know when it was going to stop. At that time, I was the one on the phone with the singles nationwide, and I heard from them all the time that they couldn't join because of the economy. I heard sad stories. I heard terrible house situations, divorce that just left them totally underwater. I felt a responsibility employing people who were trying to pay their mortgage. It was one of the first times it kind of got more real about I'm responsible for other people's lives. And if we don't attract clients who can pay the money, what are we doing? For many years, I did only 8 at 8 Dinner Club, which is a $500 price point because it's a group date. And it was shortly after the recession that we started a more luxury product called one-on-one matchmaking. And the cost for that is $5,000. And it's almost easier to work with a luxury market when times are tough. Like, even if it's pinched for them, higher net worth, white-collar professionals, they're still flush. We have grown five times since 2008. And the whole experience of going through the recession was a great cold shower. It was a good reminder that, like, have money in the bank. Make sure that you're not overextended. Don't be too aggressive. And, you know, keep working.
We've got some pictures of Sarah Catherine Walmsley on our Instagram. We are at Marketplace APM. Take a minute while you're there, if you've got it, and tell us how the financial crisis changed you. We're using the hashtag #HowWeChanged. Coming up.
The company may decide, you know, we're not getting paid here. We want this person to have to spend some time in jail. And then maybe they'll work harder to pay us.
Interesting business model, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 0.9% today, 218 points, closed at 24,189. Did the blue chips? NASDAQ slipped 0.3%, 25 points, 7,069. The S&P 500, 0.5%. To the worst, 14 points, 26 and 42. Energy companies ticked up along with the price of crude oil today. ConocoPhillips pumped up 1.4%. Chevron gained 1/3 of 1%. BP filled up about 0.1%. Crude, by the way, highest it's been since the end of 2014, $67.17 a barrel. That's up 2.5% just today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.77%. And you're listening to Marketplace. We hear from listeners like you every day that Marketplace helps you understand the financial forces that affect your lives so you can make better decisions. Well, here's your chance to be part of our efforts to raise economic intelligence across this country. When you support Marketplace today, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at the Candida Fund. As a nonprofit news organization, we're counting on your help so that we can grow and keep getting better. Become a Marketplace investor today. Whatever amount is right for you, it goes twice as far right now. Give online at marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Paul Ryan's most lasting achievement, as Kimberly and I were talking about at the beginning of the program, most likely is going to wind up being the tax package that became law late last year. There was a lot in that thing, of course. One key part was new limits on the deductibility of state and local taxes. Specifically, those deductions have been capped at $10,000. High tax states whose residents are going to be hit by that limit are looking for workarounds, ways people can get those deductions back. New York is first among them, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains.
New Yorkers have the highest state tax burden in the country. So many New Yorkers were especially annoyed when the new tax bill said they couldn't deduct as much of that as they used to come tax time.
Make no mistake about it, it's an assault on New York.
Mark Jaffe is president of the New York Chamber of Commerce. He says it's unfair that New Yorkers, well, New Yorkers making a lot of money anyway, are losing out on this tax deduction.
We actually give more in our taxes to the federal government than we get back.
Now, New York has come up with a few tricks for its wealthy citizens, and states all over the country are watching to see how they go. The tricks all boil down to this. The state income tax isn't deductible, so let's turn it into something that is. First option, disguise the not very deductible state income tax as a very deductible charitable contribution to a charitable fund, also known as the State of New York. But also to some actual charities.
People will be giving to several funds that the New York State sets up.
David Kamen is professor of law at NYU.
One of the funds is a fund towards health. Another fund is a fund towards elementary and secondary education.
What was once a not very deductible state income tax is now magically a totally deductible charitable contribution.
This runs into some serious legal headwinds.
Jared Walczak is a senior policy analyst at the Tax Foundation.
Under current law, for something to be claimed as a charitable contribution, it has to be genuinely charitable. The state actually needs to benefit, but they're largely not benefiting. They're giving almost all of it back in the form of a tax credit.
But wait, wait, maybe it will work, says David Kamen at NYU.
And this is based off of plans that the IRS has blessed in other states.
So who knows how that magic trick will go down? The IRS has yet to say anything. For New York's next trick, the state will give taxpayers the option to turn their not very deductible income tax into a very deductible payroll tax. This would be paid by the employer.
The challenge is not really a legal one here. You can almost certainly do this.
Jared Walczak again from the Tax Foundation. Swapping out an income tax for a payroll tax sounds easy, but it's actually super complicated, and employers would have to do some accounting gymnastics that would, on paper, lower wages.
This is going to be very difficult. You have contracts, you have labor agreements, you might have minimum wage issues.
Some businesses might take advantage, but not all businesses will.
New York Chamber of Commerce's Mark Jaffe again.
It's an idea that needs to be tested.
Tested it will be. New York has its magic tricks all laid out. Question is, will the IRS buy it? In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Here's another public finance story, court fees and fines this time. In Arkansas, and some other states as well, private for-profit companies are hired to manage the fines and fees that people who are arrested often have to pay. The companies run the system for the courts and in turn get to charge people fees to manage their cases. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Sarah Weitz-Kotichek from Arkansas Public Media reports on a county court there that got rid of its probation company.
Jamie Mann lives in eastern Arkansas. Over a decade, she paid over $15,000 for charges that ranged from traffic violations, like not wearing a seatbelt, to fines for things like using fake car tags, disorderly conduct during an arrest, and drug possession. Mann says that charge involved carrying prescription drugs in a bottle with the wrong label. It all started in 2005, when she was cited for several traffic violations.
And then it started spiraling out of control. And I was so mad, I remember, because I thought, I paid this ticket.
About a third of what she wound up owing was for late fees for non-payment of the original fines. She spent nearly 2 months in jail and worked almost 400 hours of community service. And in addition to the $15,000, she paid monthly fees to the Justice Network, the probation company managing her case. Mann was caught up in a system that has now come under scrutiny. Last year, two judges opted to give amnesty to probationers like Mann, and now the Justice Network is suing the county for lost income.
The Justice Network did not come out on their own and decide who was going to be on probation, what services were going to be provided, or how long they were going to be in this program.
That's Randy Fishman, attorney for the Justice Network. The company is based in Memphis, but has offices in Arkansas and Mississippi. In 2015, it reported charging Arkansas's Craighead County probationers more than $245,000 in fees. Last year, after 20 years in the county, the Justice Network left town. That was after the probationers were given amnesty days. They formed long lines to have their fees and fines forgiven.
And I have scratched every single dime that has come before me, and I'll continue to do that.
That's Judge Tommy Fowler, who ruled on the amnesties. He spoke to local KIT television last year. He says he dismissed some court costs and opted not to collect some fees and fines owed to the Justice Network. John Miles helped Fowler and another judge get elected in 2016 on a platform to get rid of private probation in the county. Miles is a pastor at the First United Methodist Church in Jonesboro.
The only people you find at the Justice Network were the poorest people in this county. And so, I mean, they were ruthless to them.
Chirag Baines is a fellow at the Harvard Law School. He says the private probation business model presents a conflict of interest because the companies can influence judges.
For example, the company may decide, we're not getting paid here. We want this person to have to spend some time in jail, and then maybe they'll work harder to pay us.
Justice Keith Blackman, one of the county's former judges who worked with the Justice Network, said in a brief phone interview that the fees, fines, and service hours he ordered were manageable. Jamie Mann, who got into debt, says because the court revoked her driver's license, she couldn't get to her community service hours.
It doesn't matter what you do, you're not going to come out ahead.
Convinced that the amnesty didn't apply to her situation, Mann got a private loan at an interest rate of 9.4%. to pay off her remaining debt. An appeals court is now considering whether a federal judge was right to throw out the Justice Network's case. In Little Rock, I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotichek for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, an indicator perhaps of the hurdle that Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook face in getting back in people's good graces. A study out from the Harvard Institute of Politics of People 18 to 29 showed that 71% of respondents don't trust the company to do the right thing. That's the verbatim question. Do you trust the company to do the right thing? That question was also posed about Congress in that same survey, by the way. 79% of people don't trust them, which is a whole nother kind of problem. And we are out of here. The Dow Industrial is off 0.9% today, about 218 points. NASDAQ gave back 0.3%, 25 points. S&P 500 down 0.5%, 14 points. Sarah Brugger, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.